Have you ever wanted to be the first to know if aliens really exist? Well, with Nebula, you can be! Nebula is the streaming service that's home to It's Probably Not Aliens, as well as our YouTube channels. And the best part? All of our content goes up early on Nebula. So when we break first contact with ET, you'll be the first to find out. That's right, you'll be able to listen to the next episode of this show before anyone else. Plus, we post bonus content that you won't find any other place. And the best part? By signing up for Nebula at nebula.tv/probablynotaliens, you're directly supporting the show and both of us. So don't wait any longer. Join Nebula today and be the first to know if this time it really is aliens.
This is exciting. This is a momentous episode.
Yeah, this is my glorious return. Or no.
Well,
this,
that, okay. Yes, absolutely. You're back behind the wheel. Thank goodness.
Yeah, back behind the wheel with a video episode that I wrote back in November. So it's like, okay, like what did I do again? What did Tristan write again?
That was me. Never stop saying video.
Nope, it's too ingrained in my head. But yeah, Scott, there is a bit of a special answer or a bit of a special way to start this particular episode of It's Probably Not Aliens.
Yeah.
Which is, at least as far as we know right now, This is the closest we could get to it maybe, possibly, probably not, but could be aliens.
Aliens.
Yeah, that's the teaser of this one. And you're gonna have to find a way to make a wonderful episode title out of the topic of today's episode, which is named ALH84001.
That is a lot and also nothing.
It's like, yeah, let's see. It's an SCP or something like that, right?
We'll figure out a catchy title for it. But hey, folks, this is It's Probably Not Aliens, a podcast where we look at ancient aliens and ancient astronaut theory and just conspiracy theories about aliens in general. And we usually debunk them while teaching you a lot about interesting history and cultures and sometimes science. But it sounds like today we might not debunk aliens. We might confirm aliens.
Okay, well, I feel like if that was the case, it would have made the news.
That's true.
But okay, let's get into a little bit about this. So Ancient Aliens.
Introduce yourself first.
Oh, yeah. I'm Tristan Johnson, and I am really, really stretching my knowledge of science, material science, and biology for today.
And I'm Scott Nicewander. I am back to my rightful place after the last two episodes of being the one to present information. I am now back into my comfort zone of knowing nothing. I know nothing about this, and Tristan's going to talk to me about it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And also, no pressure, but I got an email yesterday saying that my old PhD supervisor listens to the show. So, hi, Rob. Said we had a good rapport, so sweet.
Oh, also, can I just say really quickly on the idea of me knowing nothing? A couple episodes ago, when we had Trey the Explainer on, I mentioned that the Jonas Brothers made the song Year 3000, and apparently they just covered that song, and everyone wanted to let me know that I was wrong.
Yeah, that's a bigger mistake than my Homo erectus equaling Neanderthal slip up. So
thank you for everyone for sending corrections about the big stuff and the little stuff. We appreciate it at Probs Not Aliens on Twitter. Anyway,
the way that Twitter works is that the lower the stakes of the disagreement, the more ferocious it is. That's that's generally how it works.
That's true.
Have you watched a movie by a Mr. David Cronenberg called The Thing?
Oh, yes. I have seen this.
About a alien that shows up in Antarctica and does a bunch of body horror. I actually haven't seen it, but that's about generally the gist of what I would think.
It's good. It's real good. Hey, hot take. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I'll probably watch it at some point. I'm weird enough that my experience of David Cronenberg is him playing a role in the cast of Star Trek Discovery right now. Anyways, we're going to a new place that we haven't been to before in the history of this podcast, and that is we are going to Antarctica. Yes. So,
well, we've tackled Antarctica a little bit with the Piri Reis map.
Yeah. Now I remember that Scott is an itty bitty baby with an itty bitty head.
Thank you.
So you would not have been as old as I was, but I was like, you know, prime, like a seven or eight year old when this was going down. So it was like designed to make me excited. But in 1996, NASA said that they might have found in Antarctica a meteorite that came from Mars.
Whoa.
And that inside this meteorite was evidence of fossilized bacteria.
Okay, this is sounding familiar. Have we talked about this in another episode before? I can't remember.
It's probably not, but it's got a very like wide area. Like this is a pretty well-known part of Mars lore. And so the meteor goes by the name of the very, very, catchy name of ALH84001.
Great.
Now, on Ancient Aliens.
Can we just call it Al?
Al? Okay. So Al.
Yeah.
Now, in Ancient Aliens, they said that they basically didn't even have any pause. They were like, oh, yeah, like you guys think that aliens are so out there. But in Antarctica in the 80s, we found one already. So, like, you know, this is already established. And I'm like, wait, oh, OK. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that if that was the case, it would have, again, it would have made the news. Although I do have a theory that with our social media being the way it is, that we will at some point discover evidence of extraterrestrial life or even extraterrestrial intelligence. And it will go through the news cycle. People will have takes. There will be a couple educational YouTube videos about it. And like a month and a half later, we'll just be back to normal.
Yeah, it'll be like a TikTok meme for a week and a half.
Yeah, there'll be like a meme about like what the alien, like what's it called? Like My Aliens or something like that. Like, I don't know. They'll take like the signal and mix it into a dubstep thing and they'll put it onto the throat singing thing from Dune. It'll be perfect.
Yeah. There'll be a whole dance about it that people will learn and make memes about. It's going to be a good week and a half.
Before it's just like, yeah, aliens exist. So what? I still got to get up and go to work tomorrow. So did we find evidence of alien life in Antarctica in the 1980s?
Now, did the news cycle in the 1980s work as quickly as today?
Well, we'll find out that it was discovered in the 80s, but it wasn't speculated that there was life in it until the 90s.
Okay.
But the answer to all of this is maybe. Probably not, but there's a little bit more of a question mark than there has been in previous episodes of this show.
I heard some glint of hope in there. Some potentiality.
Yes. There is some disagreements between different types of scientists. Although one that is very pro meteor being fossils is the people who published the thing in the first place and would have a lot of motivation to really, really, really want it to be alien.
So, a little biased there. Okay,
we'll chew in that. We'll see where it goes.
Tell me about this. So this is a meteorite, yes?
That is the rumor that this is a meteorite.
All right.
So
the meteorite in quotes.
Yeah. So it was found in a place called called Allen Hills in Antarctica on December 27th, 1984.
Oh, cool.
Allen Hills is a very interesting area. And this is sort of the thing that inspired the thing, this region. Because what it is it's this field in the snow, right? So pure white. And over a period of, because of like the way the geography is shaped, over a period of centuries, the snow kind of very slowly flows in a direction and also kind of bunches up in a certain area. Why this is interesting is asteroids land all over the world all the time.
Constantly.
Including Antarctica. Now, asteroids typically are black, and black things on a white surface are very easy to find. Furthermore,
super contrasty, yeah.
Yeah. Furthermore, the way that the snow flows, a bunch of them get caught in this sort of little area before they actually eventually make it out to the sea. But there's sort of like an area where, because of the way that the flow of the snow goes, there's a really good place to go and find meteorites. So it was discovered by a group called the ANSMET Project, which was a basically it was a group done by the Office of Polar Programs for the National Science Foundation, good old American funded public science. And they were geologists who went around in Antarctica on snowmobiles looking for meteorites. Sounds like a pretty fun way to spend the Antarctic summer.
How do you get that job? I want to do that. Can I? Can anyone do that? Do I have to be a geologist first before I get to do the
probably
cool
have to
stuff?
Be a geologist?
Man.
You just be like, I found a meteor. That's a penguin.
What do you mean? I'm looking for a black thing on a white thing. I got it. It's a meteor. Is this so? I don't want to spoil anything that you might be. I don't know if maybe I'm just slow to put this together, but is it called ALH-84001 because it was found in Allen Hills in 84 and it was the first one they found and only one they found?
Very astute, Scott. You got it.
I did it.
That's how it got its very unique and colorful name.
So we're not far off by nicknaming it Al.
Yeah. So, So what happens is these meteors land in the snow, snow falls on them, they flow down this area, they get stuck at a certain point, and then the wind sort of erodes the snow away. And so you get this area where there's a big higher concentration of meteorites, and they're easy to find because it's black on white. That's that's the trick. And this region was apparently part of the inspiration for The Thing, and also an inspiration for probably the novel I am the most ashamed to have read. It's called Deception Point.
Okay.
I do not recommend. So Deception Point is a novel by Dan Brown of Da Vinci Code fame. This is his pre-Da Vinci Code.
All right.
And spoiler alert for a very bad novel. But it basically it's about a guy who fabricates finding an asteroid with fossils on it in order to help because there's a presidential election happening at that time.
Okay.
Where one of the candidates is campaigning on cutting all funding to NASA. And so they make this fake asteroid in order to get this guy to lose the election and make sure that NASA gets funding.
That's wild.
In a very Dan Brown fashion. So like each chapter was like 6 words long and like, yeah.
You know, I never read any of Dan Brown's books, but that's the thing that people always say about it is like, that's the reason people keep reading it because it's such a quick, like, you know, just every chapter is like 30 seconds long. Yeah.
I have weirdly enough read Dan Brown novels, and there is a time where there is 2 chapter headings on the same page. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's intense.
That's pretty well. Thankful. I mean, that's good use of the page. At least he didn't have to skip, like, do a whole page break or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for looking out for the environment, Dan Brown.
Yeah. So when they found Al, they immediately thought that, oh, this likely came from Mars, a planet we are very interested in because it has a very there's a lot of evidence that in its past there was a lot of conditions on the surface that were amicable to life.
Okay.
To the point where, you know, some of the more adventurous theorists might think that life on Earth might have gotten its start on a meteorite from Mars.
Yes. I think we talked about that in one of our first 2 episodes.
Yeah, it's panspermia is the concept.
Yes.
So this asteroid was about a little under 2 kilograms or in American 4.3 pounds.
Thank you for converting for me.
And it was shaped apparently like a, quote, rounded brick or large potato and about 6 inches long by 4 inches by 3 inches. And because of the friction of the Earth's atmosphere when it was coming in, when it burned up, the outside looks like it's covered in tar. And what it actually is like a sort of crust called fusion crust that happens when meteors Ooh. Come through the Earth's atmosphere.
Now, does Matt Damon know about this large potato from Mars?
No, he unfortunately, he died on Mars. He didn't realize the potatoes were full of perchlorates, and so he was poisoned.
Oh, no. R.I.P. He's doing, like, cryptocurrency ads nowadays anyway.
Yeah, screw him.
Yeah, you know what? Get away, Matt Damon.
Yeah, it's probably not real money. That's going to be the next podcast we do. Owl, people got really excited about Owl when they first saw it because it looked like it was green, which is a really good sign that there were biomarkers. But then when they took it back to study it, they was like, okay, it's much more gray. But what really stuck out about this particular meteorite is that it's thought to be one of the oldest Martian meteorites ever found, possibly crystallized from molten rock over 4 billion years ago.
Okay. Now that's interesting. It's a really old rock.
Yeah.
Really old space rock.
Mm-hmm. Probably in a volcano.
That's even cooler.
Yeah. Another really, really cool thing about this asteroid is that the chemical composition of it suggests that when it was formed was during the time when Mars was a lot warmer and a lot wetter. So there's liquid
water.
Oh,
better for life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there have been other meteorites that have what are called potential biological markers or biosignatures. So like chemical compounds that tend to possibly signal that that they were created by life. But no meteor was from the time when Mars was wet, when it was at its most likely to actually have life on it.
Okay.
So as far as we know, the only meteorite that originates from liquid water time Mars is Al. Just to show how special Al. This meteorite is.
Yeah, lots riding on Al.
Mm-hmm. So they likely think that a meteor hit Mars about 17 million years ago, blasting the rock into space. And then about 13,000 years ago, it made its way to Earth, where it fell from the sky and landed in Antarctica.
Oh, man. Glad we found it. Could have just landed in the ocean.
Yeah.
We never find
it. More likely than not, it would have done that, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's the rough timeline from 4.1 billion years ago to 13,000 years ago. Long journey for this rock.
Very long journey, mm-hmm. but Al made it.
So here's some interesting things to show you about why Mars this time was so interesting. One, an isotopic analysis indicated that the carbonates, this is science words.
Okay.
But, basically, a study of the isotopes, which is sort of charged particles in it, showed that Al probably turned into a rock when Mars had a temperature of about 18 degrees Celsius, which is 64 degrees American.
Thank you. Thank you for more conversions. Okay.
And that there was water and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
All right. That sounds important.
The carbon and oxygen isotope ratios imply that the from the deposition of the carbonates, means that implied that it was on a surface that gradually evaporated, which means that it probably was in a shallow aquifer less than 10 meters below the surface of the planet.
Of Mars?
Yes.
Oh.
So
there's, okay.
Close to the surface, warm temperature.
Water.
Water, yeah. Carbon dioxide.
These are feeling like the juices of life happening here.
Exactly. And in further research, like people are still looking at this meteor. It's still a priceless artifact. You imagine there's not a ton of Mars rocks on Earth. All of our rovers, none of them have come back. So we haven't really been able to get our
hands. One-way trip so far.
Yeah. So this is the only time we've ever been able to really get our hands on a Mars rock and really look at it. But apparently in April of 2020, some researchers discovered that there are actually nitrogen-bearing organics in Al.
Oh, this is recent then.
Yeah. This is still an ongoing story.
Yeah.
And as we learned, though, in the episode with Lena Vincent, organics are not necessarily life, but it is a sign of something interesting that could be life.
Oh, see, I like that because many people have pointed out that my job on this podcast is just to say interesting every couple of minutes. And so when you're saying that finding organics isn't necessarily life, but it is interesting, I have to agree. It is Interesting.
The astrobiologists are very intrigued.
They think it is also interesting.
And while we're on the topic of biosignatures, it's a little aside because Lena's actually been talking about it on her TikTok and I wanted to bring it up, which is that also Curiosity, the current Mars rover that we've got going around and doing stuff, has found an enrichment of carbon-12 on the surface of Mars. So forgive me, everybody who knows anything about science, but from what I can tell, carbon is basically, as far as we know, it's a necessary, thing for life because
sure.
It makes crystalline shapes really easily. And it's like, almost like the most Lego-y of atoms.
Connects together all good.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things is that ions, which is like whether or not it has extra electrons or not enough electrons, means that it has a sort of charge. Now, there's three major ways that carbon can be. Can't really explain it, but like it's carbon 12, 13, and 14, primarily carbon 12 and 13. On Earth, carbon 12 specifically is the organic compound that is very often in living things and created and processed through living processes. Now, there are plenty of ways to make carbon 12 in these kinds of concentrations that are not biological, but it is a possible explanation of the many explanations. And this just happened. This happened in January.
This is news. This is hot off the presses.
So the voyage to discover if Mars had life on it at one point is still very hot. We with Curiosity especially, we are tantalizingly close to maybe getting some very interesting answers in the next little bit.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like a throwback to a previous time when we were looking at this and when we were thinking about Mars rocks having life on them.
Yeah. I know that there's like legitimate reasons, everything that you've laid out, but there is just something so special about Mars specifically having life on it. Like the Martians have just been a part of science fiction forever, and to confirm any would be just spectacular in a very fun way.
Yeah. Furthermore, if we find out that there was life on Mars, even if it's very simple, if we find out that that life also developed in a completely different biochemistry than ourselves, then that means that we have had two incidents of life forming in this solar system, which says a lot, hopefully, about the idea that there's life elsewhere in the universe. Because if it's happened twice in our solar system,
so close by,
yeah, that it's possible that it could be life could be in almost every solar system.
Life could be everywhere. Life could be all around us, and we wouldn't know.
And if not Mars, there are still a lot of very interesting corners that we can look in, like there are still some moons of Jupiter that you'll love this. They're like big balls of ice. And because of the gravity of other Jovian moons and Jupiter itself, it gets kind of like deformed like this, like you're kneading pizza dough.
Oh, fun.
And this creates heat on the inside of these like ice ball moons.
Yeah, like friction,
enough
right?
That the interior has liquid water.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah. So the big one is Europa. So there's some cool. I'm sorry, I'm like going down all these like astrobiology circles.
No, there could be an inside ocean. There could be an inside ocean filled with lots of interesting critters and creatures.
Yes, I for one would love to see the inside ocean.
That would be fun. I'm going to take a big cannonball into that inside ocean. What are the words that I say on this podcast, Tristan? Why do I say these words? Like they're just nonsense words that come out of my mouth every so often.
It's all fun. It's all fun. That's how we get Destroy Me, History Daddy.
Ruin Me, History Daddy.
Just to throw another fun one while we're at it, why not? Is if you want to be a little bit more exotic, there is a moon called Titan around Saturn that if it's not water that we require, but we require like liquid, liquid to do biochemistry in.
A little stew, yeah.
Yeah, Titan it's so cold that it has water on it that is in the form of ice that's as hard as rock, but methane, which is a gas here, it's so cold that the methane is liquid and it has a sort of like methane-like water cycle where it like evaporates and it rains liquid
methane. Yeah. All right. Man, space is wild.
Yeah.
Has anyone talked about this before? Space is wild.
Space is wild. Speaking of space being wild, so 1984, we discover Al. Scientists take it back to their laboratories, poke around with it, mess around, write papers about it. And then in 1996, a group of scientists discover something what they think is very interesting.
How old were you in 1996?
1996, I would have turned 8 that year, that November.
I would have turned...
I have to do math and it's like 3. I would have been like 3 years old, I think. Yeah. So you can imagine being a 7 or 8 year old, this being very fun. I do remember when this came, when this was discovered, because I was also a giant nerd when I was a child. Some things never change.
We're not too far off in age then. If I would have been 4 and you would have been 8.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought you all, every time I mention that I'm 29, you're always just like, oh, Scott, wait until your 30s. I like for as if you're like late 30s or something.
Because I have a kid. I'm like, you know, I'm old at heart. but yeah, I was just born in 1988. So
there you go.
Ronald Reagan was president. But
oh, well, that's not your fault.
Yeah, I know. So in 1996, they find something very interesting, which is possible evidence of microscopic fossils that look like bacteria.
Okay.
And from the way they talk about it, it doesn't look like it's contamination. It looks like this is a fossil of a bacteria from Mars.
So I did not know fossils could be that small unless these are really big bacteria.
Actually, they're extremely, extremely small. And we'll get into why that might be a problem.
Okay.
But yeah, like very, very, very small bacteria. So this is a huge deal.
Yeah, I would assume so.
On August 6th, 1996, a team of researchers led by NASA scientists, including the lead author of the paper on this, who's a guy named David S. McKay, who will remember that name. He announced that this meteorite might have had trace evidence of life on Mars. And this was the day before they published the article. Now, remember when I said, like, hey, if like we discovered life, that probably would have made the news. This made the news.
What?
They published the article in Science, which is like literally the biggest science journal there is. And immediately this made headlines around the world. At one point, even President Bill Clinton made a speech about the discovery.
Yes, this is wild. You've put a link in the notes here.
Yeah, maybe we can put like a real fun little clip in here so I can just give you more work while you're like overworked.
No, I'll try to remember. I was going to say, should we listen to it? But it's 10 minutes long, so we're not going to listen to the entirety of it. But I definitely want to pull a fun clip.
Good afternoon. It is well worth contemplating how we reached this moment of discovery. More than 4 billion years ago, this piece of rock was formed as a part of the original crust of Mars. After billions of years, it broke from the surface and began a 16 million year journey through space that would end here on Earth. Today, rock 84001 speaks to us across all those billions of years and millions of miles. It speaks of the possibility of life. If this discovery is confirmed, it will surely be one of the most stunning insights into our universe that science has ever uncovered. Its implications are as far-reaching and awe-inspiring as can be imagined. Even as it promises answers to some of our oldest questions, it poses still others even more fundamental. We will continue to listen closely to what it has to say as we continue the search for answers and for knowledge that is as old as humanity itself, but essential to our people's future.
So was this the moment? Was this first contact? Did we find fossilized bacteria from a Martian meteorite? From day one, this was already controversial.
You couldn't, like, Tristan, you know I love you. You're a good pal of mine. You couldn't let me live in that question, in that thought for more than 2 seconds. Like, yeah, did we find it? And immediately you're shutting it down. That's so cruel.
Well, this event set off a fight, and the scientists have been fighting ever since.
All right. Well, let's hear about it.
So I will point out, I want to be completely like, I don't want to like, you know, stir false controversy or false like consensus. The wider scientific community doesn't think that this is alien life.
Oh man.
Because basically over the years since they made this announcement in 1996, Many studies have been done trying to figure out what kind of non-biological processes might have created these fossils and other sort of indicators of life that are in this asteroid as well. And so far, there have been non-biological explanations for all of them. But we'll get into that a little bit. But because those don't require assuming that there is life on another world, which is something that we've never seen before, they are more likely solutions. They require less assumptions.
A little Occam's razor sort of thing.
But despite that,
okay,
Al was a huge deal for science in general. Even if it's not convincing evidence that there was life on Mars, this paper and the attention that it got was one of the biggest turning points in the developing science of astrobiology. Astrobiology itself would not be close to where it is today if it wasn't for the buzz and attention that Al brought in this 1996 announcement.
That's amazing. I'm excited to hear about what all they found and all the fun things that have paved the way for this new field of science. You gonna tell me about it?
I will, Scott. After cereal or mattress.
After some great brand advertising, if there is any, there might just be a small break. Who knows? Tristan, I love product so much.
I love product or service.
It's my favorite part. Product or service. Both of them. If I could have both, don't make me choose. Don't make me choose between product or service. They're both great.
I have a young son that I would clearly... No, I'm not going to do that. I would sell for product and service.
I've had this little scoundrel for just a couple weeks and already I can tell he's worth at least a couple months of service. And or a couple orders of product.
No, he's great. I love him very much. Please don't take him away. Okay, so what did they find? What did the 1996 paper really find?
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, so let's take a look at the different things that they might have found. So how they looked at it is they looked at the asteroid under a scanning electron microscope, which if you've ever seen any of those pictures, like if you've ever seen you've probably seen some little news interest story of like person makes world's smallest violin. And you see this kind of gray blurry thing. That is looking at something under a scanning electron microscope. It uses it shoots electrons at little things that are very, very small.
Very small.
You can image stuff. This is like the way that we can look at things that are like atoms in size and do nanotechnology work and things like that.
I want to look up one of these world's smallest violin because I don't know if I've seen this. I'm just getting a whole bunch of stock photos of people having itty bitty violins in their hands. That's fine. I'm getting a lot of Squilliam Fancy Son from SpongeBob. I'm just going to take your word for it. They're itty bitty violins that only electrons can see.
Yeah, because they're like, they'll be like, this is 1/100th the width of a human hair. Like, that kind of, you've probably heard something like that, right?
Yeah, there's been stuff like that. I'm familiar with the concept.
Mm-hmm. So under the scanning electron microscope, they found what they thought were fossils of bacteria that was about 20 to 100 nanometers in diameter, which is key because what this would be is evidence of a theorized form of life, which they called nanobacteria, which is bacteria very smaller than any cellular life that exists on Earth. When we're getting into that size, we're talking about viruses, but not like anything that actually has a cell.
And what would 20 to 100 nanometers be in American?
I don't know if the metric or if the imperial system goes that small.
How many inches is that?
I'm going to freaking look this up now. 100 nanometers in inches. It is 3.93701 times 10 to the power of -6 of an inch.
Oh, I understand now. Now with that context and that framework, I now understand. This is pretty small then.
Yeah, real, real small.
Mm-hmm. I don't think my measuring tape goes that small.
It's actually a very average size. No.
Look, God. when you compare it to like a bell curve, like it's right there, you know? Like it's
oh man. Really earning our tag today. So nanobacteria were proposed to be a class of organism that were smaller than what we thought was the lower limit of life, which is about 200 nanometers. something like a mycoplasma. But since this time, we've kind of come to the conclusion that really nanobacteria are probably not possible. It's probably not able to make bacteria, or bacteria really can't be that small.
Is it just like physics gets in the way?
Yeah, I think so.
Sorry, Ant-Man.
And so... It was already like nanobacteria were already controversial at the time of the study. So this already was a problem. Like it was called the cold fusion of microbiology, which was I'm getting into cold fusion. Cold fusion was this thing that we thought that we were going to be able to do to make like a free energy source that did not require heating up hydrogen to like, you know, multiple times the temperature of the surface of the sun. And they were like, we could do it at a much lower temperature, cold fusion. And it was a thing that people were trying to do for a while. And it was not a thing that could happen.
Didn't work out.
No. So it was sort of the nanobacteria were sort of classified amongst them. So because of that, the fossils, quotations,
quote, heavy quotes,
are now suspected to probably not be fossils, but small, like non-living crystals, crystallization of like minerals and organic molecules. This is like a fossil of like some like molecules, basically.
Oh, okay. That's less exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, still cool. Hey, look, still cool. People love their crystals. People love their rocks.
So if the structures had been fossilized life forms, as was proposed by the so-called biogenic hypothesis of their formation, it would have been the first solid evidence of the existence of extraterrestrial life, aside from their origin of being, except for the possibility that they were also terrestrial contamination, i.e. it was, you know, Earth bacteria that contaminated the sample.
Oh, that feels... I mean, I don't want to like...
They more or less ruled that out, but they're okay. Also like, this all is right. Probably not bacteria either. But it was more likely contamination than it was like, you know,
yeah.
A new abiogenesis on Mars.
That sounds fair.
But even so, McKay has pointed out that, you know, contamination in other samples doesn't look like this.
Oh, it's unique. It's got a certain sort of structure.
Yeah, and the shapes in Al do look like they're intergrown and embedded in the indigenous material, and contamination doesn't look like that. So
yeah.
It's probably not Earth bacteria that have become fossilized. If anything, it's, yeah, like I said, kind of small crystalline microstructures.
Yeah, Mars crystals.
Yeah, there you go.
Mars crystals. Crystal Mars. Oh, I don't like the sound of that one either.
So that's there's been some pushback on this. Some people have pushed that this actually is microfossils, actually. In January 2010, a team of scientists at Johnson Space Center, including McKay, argued that since their original paper was published in November 2009, the biogenic hypothesis has been further supported by the discovery of three times the original amount of fossil-like data, including more, quote, biomorph suspected fossils inside two additional Martian meteorites, as well as more evidence in other parts of the Allen Hills meteorite itself. So there's been ongoing research. So as of 2009,
yeah.
McKay is still on it. He is still arguing that these could be fossils. He's looked at other asteroids and seen similar structures and in other parts of the Allen Hills, in other parts of Al, and found more of them.
Okay.
What he argues is that looking at them, you can see that these structures do resemble modern terrestrial bacteria and their appendages. And while some are much smaller than Earth microbes, others are 100 to 200 nanometers in size, which is a size bacteria can be.
That's good. That's good then. That could be it.
Mm-hmm.
This could be it. They look like it. Some of them are the size of it.
Yeah, there is a bacteria on Earth. It's actually the most common bacteria on Earth called Pelagopater ubique, which these can be about 120 to 200 nanometers. And McKay did not, in 2010, drop the idea completely that nanobacteria might be a thing.
The completely hypothetical nanobacteria could be out there.
Yeah. So nanobacteria are theorized to be RNA organisms that might have lived on Earth during the time period when Al was ejected from Mars. It also might have been as small or smaller than these structures as modern RNA viruses and viroids are often as little as a few dozen nanometers.
I did know that. I knew viruses were very, very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting this right, he's proposing, and other people who are proposing this nanobacteria thing are saying it's nanobacteria might not be around today, but it was around in the past.
Yeah, they might have existed in the deep, deep, deep past.
Gotcha.
It might be like something similar to like like what life was in the very, very beginning when life was just first coming together.
Little baby life.
Mm-hmm. And that one of the reasons that it uses RNA instead of DNA, which is closer to how viruses function. So
that makes sense. But obviously still hypothetical. No one really it's not a mainstream belief that existed.
No, this is all theory or hypothesis. This is like, this is the thing that could exist.
Could have happened.
Some of the smallest of these structures are 1 to 2 microns in diameter. So what people would argue is that like they are so, like micro 1 or 2 microns is extremely small.
Yeah.
Now
that's barely an inch.
A micron is 1,000 nanometers.
Okay.
So some of the structures are even larger. So they're the size of a micron, or they can be as much as 1 to 2,000
nanometers.
So they can be. So some of the structures are big enough that they could very well fit into the size of bacteria, even the smaller ones. But what is true is that while there are some that are, you know, big and very much fit the size of bacteria, there are also some that are too small to contain all of the systems required for life, at least as we know it.
Life's just too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of moving parts.
Another argument he made is that if you look at the way that these structures are shaped, that they resemble colonies and biofilms, i.e. they look like what bacteria look like, you know, how they grow and their sort of pattern of growth and things like that.
Do you think filmmakers got upset that these scientists already took the term biofilm from them? Because now we have to use biopic, which is fine, but it's more, I guess it would be more accurate to say biofilm.
I never thought about that.
And now, I mean, but then people get it confused because some people say biopic, which sounds more sciencey than filmy. So
I am just, biopic.
Yeah. it's complicated.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm a chicken or the egg situation, which came first.
I really don't know. To be honest, I don't even know what a biofilm is.
Basically, it's when bacteria grow into like kind of like a little, like at the bottom of a petri dish, they take it over and it's like you got this like kind of like layer of bacteria goo.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. So this is another one of the arguments that this looks like the sort of shape and structure that bacterial colonies have. But people have pointed out that there are lots of times when things that look like biological shapes suggest life are later shown to have been created through inorganic processes.
Just a coincidence they look similar.
Yeah. Now, this next one is going to get all the scientists real mad at me because it is jargony as hell. So the meteorite contains magnetite crystals of the unusual rectangular prism type and organized into domains all about the same size, indistinguishable from magnetite produced biologically on Earth and not matching any known non-biological magnetite that forms naturally on Earth. So magnetite is a crystal.
Yeah.
And basically its shape, the shape of the magnetite in this asteroid on Earth, magnetite crystals of that shape are typically made. We don't know of any way that is not biological for them to be made that way. But so that's a pretty good argument. So does this make sense? So imagine magnetite are like little crystals.
Yeah.
And they find these little magnetite crystals in this shape that looks like a rectangular prism.
Okay.
And what they're saying is, as far as we know on Earth, there is no way to make magnetite crystals this shape that doesn't involve life.
Okay. Is that true?
As far as I know, yes, but magnetite, yeah. So magnetite is if you were to find magnetite of this shape on Earth, it would be a very, very strong biosignature.
Gotcha.
It would be very likely that there is life here.
Yes, this is like a telltale sign that something lived here. Life was here.
Yeah. In 2001, though, a group of scientists were able to explain and produce carbonate globules that made similar types of magnetite crystals through an inorganic process by simulating conditions that Al likely experienced on Mars.
Oh, no. That sounds like an incredible smoking gun then of just you say that it can't happen inorganically. How about we recreate exactly what Al probably went through? And what do you know? It actually did create these exact crystals. Yeah.
Now, we'll circle back. So I'm playing the there's no, I'm kind of like, this is the argument, this is the counter argument.
All All right. I'll be the judge.
Yeah.
You'll be plaintiff and defendant, and I will be the judge if aliens are real or not.
So the next thing we got here is that it contains something called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are concentrated in regions containing the little globules of carbonate that had the magnetite in them. And these have been known to be indigenous. Now, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, have been theorized to be a material for abiogenesis, i.e. the first synthesis of materials that created the earliest forms of life on Earth.
PAHs, or PAHs, could have possibly created life.
Mm-hmm. So around that weird magnetite that they found in the asteroid, there was this chemical that has been theorized to maybe be something that made that started life on Earth.
Okay, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least interesting.
But... However, PAHs are also regularly found on objects such as asteroids, comets, uh-huh. and meteorites, and in deep space, all without the presence of life. And those are places that we do know this asteroid was in space at some point.
Okay, so this stuff's just sort of all over the place, even without life.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there are some other organics like amino acids found that are probably more likely to be actual Antarctic contamination. So actually Earth stuff.
Oh.
So Ancient Aliens has the episode that I kind of took this from talked about panspermia and talked about it as the possible origin of human life. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to kind of step back and be like, hey, you're talking about like theoretical, very simple bacteria when you're talking about like humanoid life that is so sophisticated that it can interbreed with humans. So this kind of fits into other things we've been talking about, kind of the stuff we talked about with Trey about HAR1, which is the gene that is evolving fast that's unique to humans. As like a sort of designer gene, but also if you study it, it looks very much like it's evolved. There's no sign of like, you know, genetic modification, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
can I just say, it is wild to me how many ancient aliens theories are about the creation of life on Earth, and they don't all coincide together. Like, they have so many theories that don't fit the same, because then there's this one, and then there's also, you know, the like the Anunnaki creating people, like those, maybe those fit together. You'd like have to do a whole bunch of like juggling around to try and make all of these theory. Every, you know, 14, 15, 16 seasons of Ancient Aliens, they have stuff that doesn't even fit within their own, you know, they can't, all of their theories can't be true. You know what I mean? Like, even what do they actually believe is what I wonder.
That if you put this on TV, people will watch it, and then you can put ads on it and make money.
Oh, well, we would never put ads on anything.
Yeah.
That we did. We have too much dignity for that.
Buy mattress. But the thing is, like, when it comes to DNA and stuff like that, like, the idea of us being designer, genetically designed.
Yeah.
Like, there's no evidence that our DNA looks like it has any sort of designer in it. It's very messy. It's full of all sorts of strange non-coding things. It's full of, like, retroviruses and random mutations that have been accumulating but haven't, you know, they weren't detrimental. They just built up over you know, billions of years that life has existed. And, looking at the human genome, even the HAR1 part doesn't looks like it's evolved. So,
well, there you go. You know, yeah. It's funny. It's funny that you mention all that, because I think there's, you know, growing up, learning about evolution, it was always told to me that, like, whether traits are beneficial or not decide whether they're passed down. But you mentioning that DNA is really messy and we just have a whole bunch of stuff. The truth is, as far as I understand it, that as long as it's not detrimental, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a gene doesn't have to be beneficial. But as long as it's not, you know, like, going to immediately be detrimental, then, like, yeah, you're fine. No, we'll pass it down. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're learning very quickly the power of evolution with all these COVID variants. Like, how it works is, you know, genes mutate either through, you know, encoding errors when it's like, you know, unzipping and re-zipping up DNA over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Radiation, stray, like, you know, shooting off electron hits and breaks a part of it. Something gets plugged in backwards, like, you know, it's messy, or like a virus comes in and viruses hijack your DNA to take over the cell to reproduce itself. But sometimes they just get in there and wait, or just something doesn't click off, and all of a sudden they just inject their DNA into yours and it's just there. And while some, like, you know, actively kill you, or they make you, you know, worse off because it's, you know, screwing around with your source code, most of it doesn't really make a change at all and just kind of accumulates. And it very rarely something comes that's actually beneficial.
Yeah.
And that's basically the evolution, or shouldn't say beneficial. That's the bad way to think about it. It makes you more adapted to your environment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different mindset of looking at it than how I was taught in schools, where I was always like, only the beneficial mutations get passed down. And the reality is, no, just like a whole bunch of stuff gets passed down, whether it's, you know, helpful or not helpful in any capacity. It just happens.
Yeah. Your cells are being blasted with mutagens and things all the time. And most of the time, nothing happens. Sometimes you get cancer. Cancer is like basically like when a whole bunch of mutations happen kind of in sequence, and all of the genes for shutting off reproduction, like kind of like telling the cell to, hey, chill out, you've reproduced enough, goes away, and it just keeps reproducing out of control. And then, you know, very occasionally, like something is beneficial. The one that comes to mind right now, because, you know, it's winter time, so I'm very pale, is that shrinking the melanin cells in skin in people in northern climates made us more adapted to getting vitamin D when there's not a lot of sunlight. And that's why skin color tends to have a gradient based on how close you are to the equator because of how much sun you're exposed to. And the exception, which would be the indigenous people of like northern Canada, like the Inuit people, it's because their diet was so rich in vitamin D that it didn't select for that pressure. So it didn't happen.
That's interesting. What would be the evolutionary advantage for me being bald, having that gene?
That is because the human species was designed to live long enough to have children, and that's about it. After that point, it doesn't really matter. And we have a lot of hormones in our body, specifically the male body, that are designed to make it be big and strong and hunt mammoth. But once it gets past a certain point, it kind of just the same hormones just start making us fall apart. That's why males tend to not live as long as females, because there's a lot of stuff about testosterone that is not good for your body.
Would you say I'm more of an alpha male or a sigma male? Because I'm definitely one of the two.
Definitely alpha. What's it called? Baldness is a sign of high testosterone. So
take that, betas, a concept that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's
get
back.
That was a really long digression about genetics.
That was a really long tangent.
Listen, I read The Emperor of All Maladies last year, so I need to tell somebody that I kind of know what cancer is.
Let's get back to this meteor that I also assume must be high in testosterone, for it also has no hair that I've heard of so far.
Now let's get back to Al. So it's not been conclusively shown that the meteorite, how the features of the meteorite were formed. For example, McKay would say that how they were able to recreate some of that stuff in a lab. McKay would argue that they did it with what he called unrealistically pure raw materials as a starting point. And so it doesn't actually explain the features described. And according to McKay, a plausible integrinic model must explain simultaneously all of the properties that we and others have suggested as possible biogenic properties of this meteorite. So not only do you have to have like a non-biological explanation for, you know, thing one, thing two, thing three, but you have to explain all of them.
Yeah.
And what he would argue is that, some of them, and a lot of the ones they have explained, were done under laboratory conditions, which, you know, that's not how nature happened.
I see. So McKay's firing back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that the rest of the scientific community politely disagrees with McKay.
Scientists are so polite.
Mm-hmm. And that looking at things, like, because it's so based on looking at the shape of different things in the stone, the scientific consensus is that morphology alone can't be used to unambiguously detect life. Interpreting something by its shape is very subjective, and its use alone is subject to error and misinterpretation.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Can't rely on those shapes.
Now, there is, so I I think that when we're talking about McKay, we should probably get into just the idea that in the search for E.T., for a lot of us, I imagine, we really want aliens to be real. It's really like, you know, we want to know that we're not alone in the universe. We want answers.
It would be interesting. Yeah. I mean, I tend to take that position on this show where I think it would be fun, or at the very least, my catchphrase, interesting, to discover that aliens are out there.
It would make me profoundly happy to discover it, followed by me being profoundly terrified.
Yes.
Because I'm sure there are implications people have discussed about what the answer could be. And
Well, the good news is that terror is only going to last for about a week and a half until it makes its way off of TikTok. And then
that's true. So that means that when it comes to things like this, we have to really, really, really control our motivated reasoning, because we're going to want everything to be life. And when it is life, we're going to have to be very rigorous about getting rid of any other explanation, because everyone wants it to be life. We know that. So we have to be strict.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I mean, if you're going into it asking the question, is this life, already that seems like a biased question, instead of, because you could just be asking what is this, but instead of you're going in saying, is this life? It's going to skew your perspective a little bit, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that the discovery of OWL, the 1996 announcement and everything that came with it does have a silver lining. So I want to, like, you know, walk away with a little bit of, this is the part where Tristan makes you a little hopeful.
Oh,
there you
what
go.
A change. I love this for a change.
Yeah. So I got this from a space.com article. But yeah, OWL did not conclusively prove the existence of life on Earth, but the research that was done into it did benefit science quite a bit. The announcement and discovery and all the attention that OWL got not only, like, you know, really kickstarted the field of astrobiology, but also it spurred interest in exploring Mars. Mars rovers, the reconnaissance orbiter, Curiosity, the Mars Express, this Beagle 2 Mars lander, all can be traced back to ALH-84001. The excitement of the potential that on Mars's surface, that there is clues that at some point there might have been life on that surface, has driven so much scientific research and so many amazing feats of engineering to put human-made devices on the surface of an entire other planet.
Yeah.
We are getting to the point where we're, like, considering sending people to Mars in 2030. And in the 2030s, sorry. And, like, we would never be even close to these kinds of things if it wasn't for the excitement that was driven up by OWL.
If it wasn't for OWL, the little meteor that could but didn't create life.
Yeah, one quote about it says, the ALH-84001 announcement, despite whether you are a believer of the hypothesis or not, has clearly been the guiding idea for the development of a new interdisciplinary field of astrobiology. This must be viewed as positive for the field of scientific discovery. Without the paper, the field of astrobiology may never have come to exist.
That's absolutely wild to think about how an entire branch of science came from this little space potato, and it's still being like pioneered to this day and studied, and we're, you know, obviously we've had Lena on the show. I'm upset that I missed that episode. It was very good, but that's so incredible to think about how this really important field of study just really didn't exist before this little guy.
Or at least it didn't really, like, you know, like, it didn't become like this, like, you know, department that has money and does experiments and, like, So there's like a lot, even though, like, you know, it's probably not aliens. Sorry. But the fact that it looked like it was for so long generated a lot of interest. And to this day, like, as I talked about just now, Curiosity is finding more biosignatures on the surface of Mars. And sometimes, like, I know that, like, you know, this is kind of normalized. We grew up in the space age. We know we do stuff in space all the time. The fact that we have a remote control car on another planet is wild.
That's bonkers.
And that we are finding molecules and stuff on there and reporting back about it is absolutely wild.
That's so fun. Mm-hmm. Look at us. We did it. Mario Kart on Mars. Mario Kart. Thank you.
And I will say as a postscript that the scientists behind the 96 study, including McKay, still support their original thesis. They still say that there's been no scientific data that has been presented that disproves any of their four original lines of evidence, the ones I kind of went through. And where the disagreement comes is in the interpretation of data. So they're still sticking to their guns.
I mean, you know, I guess I wish them all the best. I'm not as swayed, but I also am just learning about this all for the first time this past hour. So maybe, you know, I haven't done the research. I haven't done the studies. I've heard Tristan talk about them. And it sounds like it's probably not aliens.
Yeah, it's probably not. But I will say in this case, compared to all the other ones, if one day it turned out that they were vindicated and Al actually was fossilized bacteria, like if something that Curiosity digs up really like, you know, makes the connection come home, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
This is probably the closest that we've got to something that might be something interesting in the future, even if it's probably not.
I like this, though. This is an episode where typically we have much more definitive answers about things, and I like that at least a small sliver of this is, you know what, we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see, and we'll check back in the future, which gives you listeners more reason to subscribe to this podcast to hear us talk about it in the future.
I referenced a paper about Al that came out in 2020, so there's still work being done on this asteroid to this day. So it's the quest continues.
The final frontier.
Yeah. That is the charmingly named ALH84001.
Affectionately known as Al.
Yeah, we're going to get some Al fan art, maybe.
Get some Al fan, everyone.
Just like a little black potato.
Just draw a little black potato and then
everyone
just write.
That's the best. It's the best thing to do fan art because you can just, it's so
you
easy to draw.
You can just draw a little black potato. Everyone can do a little blob and then just write, thanks, Al. Just write, thanks, Al, and have this potato and send it to us at ProbsNotAliens on Twitter. That would
nice.
Be very fun if you could do that. We did start getting fan art of me with a really tiny head. I hate it. Thank you so much.
Yes, it's great.
It's been fun. I loved your response when someone
it's
sent
a little
in.
Big. Yeah, it's been smaller.
Someone sent in a drawing of my head being real tiny, and Tristan's response was, "That's a little big."
And he replied and made it even
made it smaller.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you so much to everyone who follows us over at ProbsNotAliens on Twitter. That is one of the best communities that I'm a part of. It's so fun. You guys are all amazing. Thank you to everyone who wrote reviews as well. I want to say a couple names really quickly. Thank you to Debosaurus, Alex Holmstock, and thank you to Top Diggs for writing all reviews. And we have a lot more reviews, and we just really appreciate the support. It's been amazing.
Yeah, and of course, this is our second project. We both have YouTube channels where we do
yes.
our own respective things. I talk about the past. I run Step Back, where I talk about how history is important and how it affects us in our ongoing day. And it's usually sad, but I'm going to try and fix that. And Scott, what do you do?
I have a YouTube channel called NerdSync, NerdSync, where I make video essays that explore art through curiosity and vulnerability. It's a lot of superheroes and comic books and cartoons. It's a lot of fun. I have some fantastic videos coming up, and hopefully they are less sad and more hopeful and inspirational. That's what mm-hmm. is that? That's going to be our goal for this year, maybe, with between all of our stuff. Who knows?
Yeah, we're the two masks, the two drama masks.
One's happy and one is more knowledgeable.
And of course, podcasts don't have a recommendation algorithm like YouTube does. So we only grow through word of mouth. So if you think this is a show that your friend would like, family would like, dog would like, I don't know
yeah.
how it would work, please share it. We grow because people say, hey, listen to this cool thing. We've been hearing about people saying that their friends are getting tired of them subjecting them to the podcast.
So wonderful. Thank you so much to everyone who's been sharing the podcast, who's been tagging us and stuff, who's been retweeting our stuff, who's just been talking about their friends about it. We have a super easy website to remember. It's probs. The website is probsnotaliens.com. It's got links to everything, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, everything. It's easy to share with your friends. If they listen to podcasts of any kind, our podcast is on there, and that site can help them find it.
And until next time, friends, the truth is out there. Probably.
I feel good about that. I feel good about that one more than ever today.